The Leslie Marshall Show, the only true democracy in talk radio of, for, and by you, the people. Live nationwide and streaming live at LeslieMarshallShow.com. Call in with your thoughts at 888-6-LESLIE.
Good evening, America. Welcome to the Leslie Marshall Show. Hey, Mark, that's not my music. It's Mark Levine. I am very, very pleased to fill in for Leslie. She calls me her favorite fill-in host. And, well, I appreciate the trust she gives in me because it gives me you, her baby, her audience. And even though the song is, you know, a woman, that's okay. I like women. They're good, right? I hope you will join me this hour and the next. We have a lot to discuss. I want to focus the first couple of hours on the Supreme Court, not just the retirement of Justice Stevens and who may replace him, but really what the Supreme Court does, what it does in our lives, how it affects our lives, what you think is the most important part about it. It's the part of our lives that, well, the part of our government, at least, that is most rarely discussed. And then in the last hour, I've got a special treat for you. An old colleague I used to work with, his name is Bob Kincaid. He's a radio host himself, and he's in West Virginia. And nobody knows what he calls the hills and hollers of West Virginia better than Bob Kincaid. He has been focused on the Massey Energy Corporation, the horrific corporation that, I argue, intentionally did practices that led to the murder of 29 innocent minors. No, Massey didn't go around killing them, but he almost did. Well, it's really Don Blankenship, the CEO of Massey Energy Corporation, who consistently has put profits above people. It's the reason why 29 innocent people, hard-working, hard-scrabble people are dead. In the last hour, the third hour, we're going to have Bob Kincaid on the air, and he's going to explain to you how West Virginia works. Politically, why the coal mines are so strong, how it is that they've even been blowing off the tops of mountains to deposit arsenic in the waters, thus poisoning everybody just to get a little bit more coal, and specifically about the Massey Energy Corporation, a company that has had 1,342 citations and only 1,922 days of operating, virtually one citation a day, 50 last month, including, guess what, citations for running the air backwards, causing more explosive methane to be in the mines. Anyway, we'll talk a lot about that in the last hour. Of course, I'm going to encourage you to call in during all 3 hours. You know the number. It's 888-6-LESLIE, 888-653-7543. Let's start talking about the United States Supreme Court. You know, we talk about the president all the time. I dare say there's nary a single radio show that I do where President Obama's name isn't mentioned, or Leslie, or for that matter, Rush Limbaugh. The president is the center of attention, just as for several years, Bush was practically in every single radio show I did. And for obvious reasons, the president has tremendous powers, and as a single individual, he has, he or she, I should say, because we may have a female president one day, but for now, he is the target of intense focus. That's as it should be. Next most intense, of course, is Congress. People are always marching on Congress. As I live here in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area, I have many, many, many times, more than I can count, seen protests, marches on that beautiful structure called the Capitol as people go across the malls, whether they're pro-war or anti-war, pro-life or pro-choice, whether they love their guns or whether they want to protect immigrants, marching on Congress is tried and true. Complaining about Congress is also tried and true. It's sort of an American pastime. Most Americans love their individual Congress person. They like their member of Congress, but they don't tend to like Congress in general because Congress, after all, is a 535-headed beast where the majority rules, sometimes the supermajority rules. It is complex. It is filled with regulations. It is filled with compromise. Unlike the president, the Congress can't do, an individual congressman or congresswoman can't do what he or she wants. He or she has to find hundreds of others to agree with him or her. And in the process, some unsavory deals are made. So people complain about Congress all the time. The Supreme Court? Well, not too many people focus on the Supreme Court. If you ever make a trip here to Washington, and I hope you do, every American needs to come to the nation's capital, needs to see their government at work, please stop by the United States Supreme Court. You'd be amazed how few tourists do. Again, I've been living in this town in metropolitan Washington for, oh, God, almost 10 years now. Wow, that's a long time. It'll be 10 years in 2011, so 9 years now. And I have seen lots of people peek outside the White House with the cameras and so forth. And I have seen people in the tens of thousands, nay, the hundreds of thousands, march on Congress. But you know what? Virtually every time I go to the United States Supreme Court, and I probably go there a third of the time, it is our third branch of government, I can't tell how many times the steps to that beautiful column building are empty. Oh, people line up when there's an opinion, but how many people line up? 20, 30, 50, unless it's a really important opinion. Did you know how easy it is to see your government at work? It's so easy. You walk into Washington. Of course, you go through a metal detector, as well you should. But you don't need a reservation or anything. You know, you need to call several weeks or months in advance to get in the White House. The Capitol, you have to get your member of Congress's permission. Not the Supreme Court. You just walk right in, you know, through the metal detector. But you can see those nine, I'd call them famous individuals, except that most Americans don't even know their names. They may have heard of Justice Scalia. He's sort of the all-purpose right-wing ideologue. But how many people even knew the name of John Paul Stevens? Studies show that, depending on how you calculate it, it's less than 5% or even less than 1%. So let me tell you a little bit about John Paul Stevens, the man he's going to retire, and let me give you the inside scoop for the next couple of hours of how the United States Supreme Court works, the good, the bad, the ugly. This is your civics class, but not just the standard stuff that you learn in your civics class, but how it really works. And throughout this hour and the next, I want to hear from you as to what issues are you most concerned about. Maybe you don't even know what issues the Supreme Court deals with. Many know that abortion is a very common issue, or prayer in schools, or gun regulations. But until 2000, nobody even considered the fact that the United States Supreme Court could choose the President of the United States. It had never happened before. But when the American people chose Gore in 2000, and when the Electoral College was going to choose Gore because Gore won the Florida vote, and therefore the Florida was going to send enough electoral votes to win the election for Gore in 2000, five justices did an amazing thing, a shocking thing. I think so shocking that it actually kind of startled me out of my reverie as a high-paid trial lawyer in Los Angeles, and brought me to Washington to be an extremely low-paid congressional attorney. The decision was Bush v. Gore, a decision that conservatives will often tell liberals to get over because they themselves know the decision was lawless, illogical, and the only coup d'etat in United States history. It's almost like the Wizard of Oz saying, "Don't look behind the curtain! Don't look behind the curtain." I will never forgive, never forgive the five justices who took hundreds of millions of American votes and threw them away, giving the second place winner, Bush, the minority winner, the one who lost the election, giving him power. As I said, it was enough to radicalize me because I'd always believed the system worked. You know, sometimes my guy wins and sometimes my guy loses, but always the person who got the most votes won. Not just the popular vote, but the electoral vote too. But not in 2000. And Justice Stevens wrote, dare I say, one of the most eloquent dissents. In fact, I think all four dissenting justices wrote eloquent dissents. But Justice Stevens wrote in Bush v. Gore that the nation had lost the idea of the Supreme Court of judges as an impartial ruler of law. He said quite clearly, and he was a very gentlemanly guy. I mean, he's 90 years old now. He was 80 years old then. But he said in a very gentlemanly fashion, let's be very clear what happened here. Bush v. Gore is lawless. It has zero basis in law. These are my words, not his. Perhaps he was too courtly to say the words I'm saying. But he made it very clear that this was not an impartial ruling. It was not a ruling based in law. It was not a ruling based in the Constitution. It was a ruling based in the fact that five right-wing, wacko, radical judges decided that they liked Bush better than Gore. And so they said to 150 million Americans, however many it was, 100 million plus Americans, screw you. We don't give a damn what you think. We're not even going to take the time to count your votes because your votes don't matter. We want Bush, therefore he wins. Or as Justice Scalia quite inelegantly wrote on December 9th of 2000, he said, to count the votes would damage the legitimacy of George Bush's claim to be president. What remarkable words. He said the word petitioner because it sounds even more remarkable to say it as I did. He said to count the votes would damage legitimacy of petitioner's claim to be president, but George Bush was the petitioner. We all know what was going on here. To count the votes would damage legitimacy of Bush's claim to be president. No doubt that's true. No truer words were ever said. In fact, counting the votes also damaged Pat Buchanan's claim to be president, Ralph Nader's claim to be president. It even damaged Mark Levine's claim to be president. That's right. Well, I guess I wasn't 35 at the time. But anyone's president if you don't count the votes. If you don't count the votes, Mickey Mouse may well be president. But this idea that you don't count the votes in a democracy is what began this lawless court on a period of increasingly judicial activism. And when we come back, I want to discuss the most right-wing case since Bush v. Gore, a case written by the person who's now going to be in the middle of the court, even more so, Justice Anthony Kennedy, the case of Citizens United, where the court held that corporations are more important American citizens than human beings. You and I and every other pesky human, we're second compared to the almighty corporation. In understanding what's going to happen when President Obama replaces Justice Stevens, you need to understand the real consequences of what the court can do for you or against you. Give me a call if you have any questions about this or if you want to give your own views on it. It's 866-653-LESLIE. 866-653-7543. Sorry, I'm trying again, Mark. 888-6-LESLIE. There we go. 888-653-7543. We'll be right back after this.
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of truth. The Leslie Marshall Show, 888-6-LESLIE. Follow Leslie on Twitter. Just go to www.twitter.com/Leslie Marshall, and we'll be sure to share your tweets.
Welcome back to Leslie Marshall Show. This is Mark Levine filling in for Leslie Marshall and talking about the United States Supreme Court. You know, it is the least talked about branch of government, and a lot of times we only talk about them when some horrid case comes down. But at a time like this, when Justice, well, who knows which justice, when Justice Stevens has retired and who knows which justice will replace him, it's important to know what the Supreme Court does, how it works, and why it's so important that President Obama picks the right person. The first thing you should know is that no matter who he picks, no matter who the president picks, our court, already lawless, already so right-wing that they did a coup d'etat in 2000 and chose a president against the will of the American people. Already so lawless that they declared just this year that corporations should have more, one single corporation should have more political power than all 300 million Americans put together. I'll explain that in a second. This court's going to move to the right. You heard it here first. I mean, Obama is supposed to be this incredible socialist liberal, according to, well, the Tea Party, I guess, and Sarah Palin. But he will be hard-pressed to find anyone to fill the shoes of the great Justice John Paul Stevens. Justice John Paul Stevens was appointed by Gerald Ford in 1975. Ford, a standard moderate Republican, in fact, the leader of the Republicans in the House before he was chosen to be vice president upon the resignation of Spiro Agnew under Richard Nixon, and then, of course, became president when Nixon was forced to resign. Gerald Ford was the leader of the Republicans. He has the post that John Boehner has today. But Ford was a moderate man. He was no liberal, to be sure. But today, according to the standards of the Tea Party and Sarah Palin and Scalia and Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh, Gerald Ford would be considered a Marxist, a raving liberal lunatic. After all, Gerald Ford believed in things like environmental protection, at least to some extent. He didn't believe that, people should have an unlimited right to pollute. Wow. What a liberal. So, Justice Stevens was appointed by Gerald Ford and was a moderate conservative in 1975, and I would argue remained pretty much true to his vision up to the present day. What changed was Ronald Reagan appointed radical, extreme, right-wing people. At that time, there was only one extremist on the bench, and that was, well, William Rehnquist, a person so extreme that he actually worked very hard in the 1950s to deny black people the right to vote. That's who's considered, I guess, normal by today's right-wing standards. And then Ronald Reagan appointed, two pretty very conservative justices, Sandra Day O'Connor and Anthony Kennedy, but the most extreme right-winger of all, Antonin Scalia. And in this hour, I'm going to tell you, about my own personal conversation, public conversation, argument, really, dispute with Justice Scalia, because he is promoted as someone who actually believes in the Constitution, who believes in the rule of law, and I proved before a live audience that actually he's nothing of the sort. He's actually an extreme hypocrite. So I have a lot to talk about over the next hour. We'll go over my own conversation with Justice Scalia in law school. We'll talk about the Citizens United case and how it held that corporations, yes, corporations, these legal fictions, one single one should have more power than all the rest of us put together. And we'll talk about what's going to happen to the court now that 90-year-old Justice John Paul Stevens is going to retire. If you want to call in and add your two cents, I'd like to hear from you. 888-6-LESLIE, 888-653-7543. We'll be right back after this.
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of truth. The Leslie Marshall Show, 888-6-LESLIE. Become Leslie's friend on Facebook. Go to www.facebook.com/Leslie Marshall and join her fan page.
Welcome back to the Leslie Marshall Show. This is Mark Levine with the honor and privilege of filling in for Leslie today. And we're talking about the Supreme Court, of course, because Justice John Paul Stevens is retiring. This is a man who may have been a conservative by the scale of 1975, but by the time he retires, he's considered the leader of the liberal wing. Because Justice John Paul Stevens actually believed in the Constitution, believed in the rule of law, believed in respecting what democratic bodies like Congress do. You know, it's funny. ever since Brown versus Board of Education, considered a radical, liberal, left-wing opinion, Republicans have run against the Supreme Court. They've assumed that it's like the Warren Court back in the 50s, that it's left of the political branches. And no doubt in 1954, when the Supreme Court said that there will no longer be segregation in America's public schools, it may have been left of the political branches, which after all were elected by all whites in the South, since blacks were denied the right to vote. And Republicans really love to run against a left-wing court. Whether it's the Miranda decision or Roe v. Wade, decisions from the 60s and the 70s, that's what they've been running against. And I think it's fair to say that in the 60s and the 70s, the court reflected the liberal opinion of the American people at that time. But since that time, since Justice Stevens was appointed on the court in 75, the court has steadily moved to the right, from the liberal to the center to the conservative to the right-wing conservative, to the radical right-wing, law-defying, renegade, lawless Supreme Court that we have today. One that doesn't give a damn what the American people vote for, doesn't give a damn what Congress votes for. Basically, they're five dictators, and they say we get to decide who the president is if it's close enough to give us an excuse. We get to decide that corporations are more important than human beings. The Citizens United case, for example, would allow one corporation, just one, Exxon, which had $46 billion in profits, to spend a tenth of its money, $4.6 billion, and still have more power, more financial power in choosing the next president of the United States than every single American who contributed to the Obama campaign and the McCain campaign and the Hillary Clinton campaign and everybody else put together. It's very scary. And Stevens was one of the last redoubts against this craziness. And now he's gone. Dean in Buffalo, welcome to the Leslie Marshall Show.
Yeah, I was just wondering what you thought of the idea of having, and I actually read this on, on Roadrunner, they actually proposed that Hillary Clinton would be next in line for one of the justice spots. I was wondering what you thought of that.
You know what? I would love to see Hillary Clinton on the Supreme Court. I could tell you, though, that President Obama squelched that rumor very quickly after it happened. It was sort of thrown out there as a trial balloon, and the White House came down and pricked that trial balloon and made it go pop very fast. President Obama said that he likes Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State. He's very happy in that job. I'll tell you why I don't think he'll pick Hillary. Well, he's already said he won't pick Hillary, so we already know he won't. But the reason why Obama doesn't dare pick Hillary, I don't think, at least not in his first term, is that Justice Stevens, when he's gone, because he was anchoring the liberal side, no matter who he picks, just anyone that Obama has a reasonable chance of getting through the Senate is going to be to the right of Justice Stevens. That's just the way politics are these days. And therefore, the court's going to move to the right, or even if he picks an extreme liberal, I don't even know what that is these days, but even if he appoints, let's say, Maxine Waters to the court, which will never happen, it won't change the balance of the court, which is four extreme right-wing justices and one justice, Anthony Kennedy, that's usually extreme and right-wing. He's, after all, the author of the Citizens United case, Kennedy, the so-called swing vote, and he's also one of the five that voted to install Bush, even though the American people voted for Gore. And he's considered the swing vote. So it doesn't really matter who he picks to replace Stevens. The real choice will happen if President Obama is reelected. If he's reelected, then he will not have to. He won't be running again. He can pick someone who's more liberal. And hopefully, if a Justice Scalia retires or a Justice Kennedy retires, Scalia will be 80 at the end of Obama's second term, and Kennedy will be 78. Then that'll really swing the court. And that would be a great time. Hillary Clinton will have served several years as Secretary of State. That would be a great time to appoint Hillary Clinton. I think she'd be great because I don't agree with everything that she does, but she's clearly a very strong voice. She's a very intelligent voice, a very articulate voice, someone who can not just give a strong reason for a policy, but give all the intellectual wherewithal to back it up. I'd love to see her as a choice, but I don't think Obama, well, we know Obama won't pick her this time, and I hope I've explained why. Do you have any more questions or comments, Dean?
Doing a substitute teacher job. Have a good rest of the night. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And, substitute teacher, that's I'm okay with that.
I just threw a piece of paper at your head, by the way, when you were turned around.
Oh, well, except for Mark. At least it wasn't a spitball, Mark. God, it's hard to throw a spitball, 1,000 miles.
That would be hard.
But if anyone could do it, Mark, I'm sure you could. No, listen, if I am your second favorite talk show host, I'm okay with that. You know, that silver medals are very pretty. I mean, come on. You can't always get the gold. Besides, I've been doing a lot of work anyway lately. I'll just brag a little bit. I was on Fox News this morning, and I was actually on MSNBC Friday and O'Reilly on Thursday. And you can find all those clips of me arguing with the right wing, supporting truth, justice, the American way. On my website at radioinsidescoop.com, so check it out. But I want to get back to the Supreme Court here and make sure you understand the dynamics of the United States Supreme Court. So the way it works is this. The Chief Justice of the United States is kind of a first among equals. He only gets one vote, and I only say he because we've never had a female Chief Justice. No, certainly no gender insult intended. But the Chief Justice is a first among equals, and basically, if the Chief Justice is in the majority of a Supreme Court opinion, he can write it himself, or he can assign whichever justice he wants to write it. And that assigning power is powerful, because if you've got someone who's on the cusp, a guy like Justice Kennedy, who's generally supporter of the right wing, again, as I pointed out, he wrote the Citizens United case. Well, Citizens United case is a good example, right? This is a case that is so far-reaching, it's so right-wing, that overturns centuries of American law restricting the power of corporation. More than 100 years of American law saying, hey, corporations, you're a legal fiction. You shouldn't be spending other people's money to support the CEO's political views. You don't have rights under the Constitution. In fact, corporation is even mentioned in the United States Constitution. You have what rights that Congress or the state governments are willing to give you. That was the law until last year when Justice Kennedy wrote an opinion saying, in effect, corporations can do whatever they want. They can buy a president if they like, and they can do it pretty cheaply because their pay scale is a little bit higher than mine or yours or all of us put together, in fact. So Justice Kennedy wrote the opinion because Chief Justice Roberts, one of the five in the majority, four in the minority, he was the Chief Justice. He assigned the opinion, and he signed the opinion to the swing vote justice, Justice Kennedy, because he knew that if he gave Kennedy the opinion, he'd get Kennedy's vote. Kennedy goes the other way. Well, Justice Roberts would probably write the opinion himself. That's what the power of the Chief Justice, the only power, in fact, of the Chief Justice, really, the main one, over his other eight equals. But the second most powerful person on the court is the senior member of the court, which was Justice Stevens, at least it has been for the last 16 years. And Justice Stevens, if he is in the majority and the Chief Justice is not, and Stevens was almost never in agreement with Chief Justice Roberts or Chief Justice Rehnquist before him, then he gets to assign the opinion. And so when we could get Kennedy's swing vote, for example, on the opinion, the 5-4 opinion that said you couldn't jail someone for being gay, that you couldn't jail someone for having oral sex with their wife or husband. Well, on that opinion, Stevens got to assign it, and he assigned it to Kennedy, and it's one of those few opinions where Kennedy sided with the liberal side. So now Justice Kennedy, this right-wing conservative, is the senior member of the liberal branch. And that's true no matter who Obama appoints. And yet, despite all of that, the Republicans are all ready to declare holy war. Let me suggest to you, it's all a feint. It's all a ruse. It's all a challenge for next time. They're making a big row now because they know that when a conservative goes and a liberal takes his place, when Justice Scalia retires or dies, which... Justice Scalia, I mean, I guess he can't help death, but I guarantee you he will not retire if he can while Obama is president. Then you're going to get the war. Then you're going to get suggestions of a filibuster. Then you're going to get an all-out attack. But what's fascinating is we've been through these battles before. We were with them when Alito was appointed by George Bush. And the Democrats, well, they kind of backed down at that time. I'll talk about that after the break. If you want to call in, 866-6... Yeah, I did it again. 888-653-LESLIE. 888-653-7543. We'll be right back after this.
Leslie Marshall. Real people. Real life. Real talk. 888-6-LESLIE. If you miss Leslie on TV this week, catch up at LeslieMarshallShow.com.
Welcome back to the Leslie Marshall Show. This is Mark Levine, your second favorite talk show host, talking about the Supreme Court and how important it is and trying to remind you of the politics of what happened in the past. It wasn't that long ago that Justices Robert and Alito were appointed to the United States Supreme Court by George Bush. At that time, the Republicans had a majority in the Senate. They were very careful to leave at that time. And some Democrats, particularly with regard to Alito, who had some very radical writings, Roberts was seen as probably radical, but there was sort of harder, no real easy proof of that. But when Roberts, and even more when Alito, was chosen for the United States Supreme Court, as I say, the Republicans had a majority in the Senate. And the only way the Democrats could really stop him from going to the court was through a filibuster. And most of the Democrats insisted they had the right to do a filibuster. Now, this was back at a time, seems like ages ago, even though it was just 2006. It was 4 years ago? This was a time when filibusters were not used with every single piece of legislation. This was a time when filibusters were rarely used, occasionally used by the Democrats in order to stop something they felt was really wrong. Today, as you know, the Republicans do it for everything. You want to name a post office, they filibuster. You want to expand unemployment benefits, even if the vote is 98-0, the Republicans still filibuster. They filibuster everything. They even have told the American people on places like Fox News that you need 60 votes in the Senate, as if that were some constitutional rule instead of a way to break a filibuster. Well, there were Democrats that threatened to filibuster Samuel Alito, given what a right-wing person he is, someone who, for example, believed that, let's find a good thing he believed in that was awful. I'm trying to remember before, because he did a lot of things since he came on the court. Oh, I'll get you something when we come back. In any case, they were thinking of filibustering Alito. And a number of moderate Democrats joined with a number of moderate Republicans, including John McCain, to form what they then called the Gang of 14. And the Gang of 14 said it is never appropriate to filibuster a United States Supreme Court judge. Well, that may be true. That may not be true. I don't want to see it happen now. But I think I'm okay with the general idea of filibustering United States Supreme Court judge. In fact, I think there's more of an argument to filibuster a United States Supreme Court justice than ordinary legislation. Ordinary legislation, you should just get a majority. That's what we vote people for. You vote for a majority, they pass it. If you don't like it, then you get a majority on the other side. You vote in new people and they repeal it. Ordinary legislation can be changed. But a Supreme Court justice... well, that's forever. That's literally till the day he or she dies, unless he or she decides to retire early. And usually they only retire early if they know they're getting a like-minded justice to replace them. it can be a legacy that not only spans one lifetime, but spans several. In fact, as long as a justice keeps retiring prior to his or her death, he or she can ensure that only people of his or her ilk will replace him or her. In other words, a Supreme Court justice is not just a lifetime, but can be several lifetimes. With something that important, remember, one justice, one person, one human being, Clarence Thomas, or Scalia, or Anthony Kennedy, if only one of them had had the respect for the American people and for the Constitution to let the voters decide who was president in 2000, we never would have had George Bush as president in the first place. We talk about President Gore, and I'm quite confident he would have served two terms. So, yes, one justice makes a tremendous difference. In that case, I actually think if you get a radical, it's okay to filibuster them. I really do. That should be something that requires 60 votes. But at this point, when we have such a right-wing court, yeah, I want to right the jar. I want to have a court in the middle before we start saying we can filibuster people. And in any case, the Republicans insisted that you just couldn't filibuster a Supreme Court justice. Well, now there are people, before even Obama appoints a new person, suggesting filibustering the justice. But would all 41 Republicans stick together? I don't think so. This isn't like health care. Because if the Republicans filibuster this justice, which, by the way, they did once before. They did Abe Fortas, who was appointed by Lyndon Johnson back in 1968. There was a filibuster. There is precedent for this. But if they were to do it, they know that if they ever got a Republican president again, that it would always require 60 votes. The Democrats would do the same, and so forth, and so on, forever. So it's kind of like a mutual game of chicken here. And I don't think they will dare filibuster, particularly as, no matter how liberal the justice is that Obama appoints, it's going to replace Justice Stevens, the leader of the liberal wing. It won't change the composition of the court. As I said, Justice Kennedy, the author of the horrific opinion that said that a corporation has constitutional rights, more rights than you and me, because, you know, you and I can go to jail. Corporations can't go to jail. We're going to talk about that in the third hour when we talk about the Massey Energy Corporation that murdered 29 innocent coal miners, or at least manslaughtered them. Negligent homicide? I think of it like drunk driving. They got in the car drunk, they knew people would die, and they did so anyway. In any case, corporations can't go to jail. They can pay a few fines. You and I can go to jail. You and I are mortal. We die. Corporations don't die. And most serious of all, we have to spend our own money when we support a candidate for president or Congress or state dog catcher. Whereas corporations, they get to spend our money. They don't spend their own money. Do you think I give money to Exxon because I support Exxon's choice of candidate? Do you think I give money to Exxon because I think that Exxon should get taxpayer subsidies? No, I give money to Exxon because I got to put gas in my car. That's the only reason I'm even at Exxon. I don't support their policies, right? I keep my house electricity. The electricity may come from coal. The coal may be paid for to Massey Energy Corporation, but like, gosh knows, I certainly don't support them. So we already have a radical court. And in the next hour, I'm going to ask you to focus on the issues that you have. What is it that you're most concerned about with the court? Is it power to corporations? How about power to the government? How about a court that approves torture in violation of the Eighth Amendment? A court that approves the government spying on you in violation of the Fourth Amendment? How about a court that declares that your state can't regulate guns? I mean, if you take the Second Amendment the way Justice Scalia says it, you can't even prevent felons from owning guns. Any crazy person can own a gun. What concerns you about your United States Supreme Court? The whole next hour, give me a call, let me know. 888-653-7543. 888-6-LESLIE. This is Mark Levine. We'll be right back. Top of the hour.
Leslie Marshall, straight and on point. 888-6-LESLIE. The Leslie Marshall Show, a true democracy in talk radio. Of, for, and by you, the people.
Oh, there's my music. Well, that's not my usual music, but heck, you know, if the song begins, woman, you might as well just scratch it out and put I'm a man. Well, I am a man, but I am filling in the large shoes. Maybe pumps as it goes. I don't know. I've never really seen what Leslie wears on her feet. I'll have to look carefully. Anyway, I am filling in the shoes of Leslie Marshall. This is Mark Levine, your second favorite talk show host, your most frequent fill-in talk show host, and a talk show host that I hope you'll explore on your own time when you're not listening to Leslie. My website is RadioInsideScoop.com. If you can't remember that, just go to MarkLevineRadio.com. MarkLevine. Radio.com. Please do not confuse me with that awful conservative nutcase who has a name similar to mine, but without the E on the end. The E makes it all work just right. We're talking about the United States Supreme Court, and specifically what we need to replace the really incomparable Justice Stevens. I know he has to go. I know he's 90. I know that it's right that he goes now while Obama's president. I understand why he's going to go in the first 2 years when you've got 59 Democrats, because, we may well lose some seats in 2010. It's a good time for him to leave, if there's ever a good time for him to leave. But I don't think there's ever a good time for him to leave. I mean, he's my hero. He's 90, but, if he were, he's going strong. And if he would go to 102, he would be clearly writing very clear, strong, well-written opinions. Not everyone I agree with, by the way. Remember, Stevens is a Republican, appointed by a Republican. In fact, I think his most egregious decision was the one where he said that you could actually put in jail for burning a flag. While I would never burn the American flag, I firmly believe in your First Amendment right to do so, even if I would be very angry at you for doing so, because that's what the First Amendment's all about. In any case, now, the most senior member on the United States Supreme Court, the one who will have been there the longest since the late 80s, been there more than 20 years, will be Justice Antonin Scalia. That's right. If Chief Justice Roberts doesn't want to write the opinion and disagrees with Scalia, Scalia, the most senior justice, gets to write it, but Scalia and Roberts will rarely disagree, if ever. They both believe that judges should trump man-made laws. At the same time, by the way, that Republicans keep up this mantra. You're going to hear it. You are going to hear. I want you to count how many times you hear during the confirmation process that's going to occur over the next, 6 to 16 weeks. Well, probably 6 weeks to choose and maybe another 50 days of hearings and so forth. Listen to how many times the Republicans talk about judicial restraint, that they don't want judicial activist judges. And the really funny thing about that is that Republicans, I think most of them, there are a few thinkers out there, but the vast majority of them, they just go by their talking points. Whatever Rush Limbaugh tells them to say, moo, ditto head, say what he says. Right? They listen to Fox News, learn their points of the day, and go off and spout them. Now, why would I say that? It's pretty insulting to say people aren't thinking for themselves. But how do I know that most Republicans aren't thinking for themselves? Because most of them continue to talk about being against judicially activist judges. Mitch McConnell, the leader of the Republicans in the Senate, indeed the most powerful Republican in government in the United States, the most powerful Republican in the federal government, the leader of the minority Senate, which has more power than a leader of the minority House, actually said that he wanted a judge with judicial restraint. Well, great. Then we agree. I firmly believe in judicial restraint. What the heck does that term mean? Well, sit down for law school, Constitutional Law 101. What judicial restraint means is that the court should generally respect the views of our nation's elected representatives. That's the way it should be. If Congress, which is elected by the American people, passes a law signed into law by the President of the United States, which is elected by the Electoral College, which is elected by the American people, exception 2000 when the Supreme Court chose the president, but in every other election year, the American people get to decide who's President of the United States. And since the elected branch of the government make laws, those laws should be obeyed, generally. That's what judicial restraint means. What the Supreme Court is supposed to do is, with most laws, to interpret where they've been left ambiguous. Where Congress and the president have written language that could mean one thing or another, then they have to figure out what they meant, and they have to interpret the law, and they have to construe what the Congress said, and they might look at legislative history, they would look at the text of the bill, they might look at the bill that it replaced, and they do what judges do. They figure out what Congress meant, and they could be right or they could be wrong, but generally they're pretty good at that. Sometimes they might let their ideology go one way or the other. For example, in the Lilly Ledbetter case, this wacko right-wing Supreme Court declared, and this is true, I'm not making this up, that even though a woman in the exact same position as a man doing identical work had been paid less than that man for 30 years, clearly violating civil rights laws, that because she only discovered that for 30 years she was being discriminated against, she could only sue for 6 months of back pay because, well, she discovered it 6 months ago. The statute of limitations had run on the rest, the courts held. Whereas the four dissenting justices, including Justice Stevens, held the more likely explanation, which is that when you discover an injury, the statute of limitations continues. In other words, if you don't know the doctor left a scalpel inside you until 2 years later when it starts cutting into your heart, you could still get enough money to get the scalpel out. Now, if you know the scalpel's there, well, then, you know, you got to sue within a certain period of time or your rights go away. That makes sense. Use your rights or lose them. But if you don't know that arsenic is seeping into your property, if you don't know that underneath your house termites have been eating away for 20 years, if you don't know that smoking, which they didn't tell you would cause cancer in 1950, actually kills you in 1990 or 2000 or 2010. Well, if you don't know that, then you get to sue later. That's a general principle of the law. These five justices said, nah, it doesn't matter that she's been discriminated against for 30 years. We'll give her 6 months of back pay. It was a crazy, wild decision and showed absolutely no sympathy for minorities. But of course, what do you expect from five radical conservative judges? I would expect more, but I know better. But because the decision was not based on the Constitution, it was just based on interpretation of federal law, the federal civil rights law, Congress could fix it. And one of the first things President Obama did, in fact, I think it was the very first legislation after he became president, the Lilly Ledbetter Law, named after the woman who's discriminated against, that said, you know what? If you just discover after 30 years you've been discriminated against, you get to sue for all the 30 years of back pay. Congress passed it. The president signed it into law. Ha ha, Supreme Court. You can rule on what Congress says, and Congress can reverse you back. That's the power of the elected branches. And that's true with regards to federal law. But there is one area where the United States Supreme Court cannot be trumped by Congress or the president. And that, of course, is the Constitution of the United States. When the Supreme Court rules according to the Constitution, no one can trump it unless you amend the Constitution, which is very hard to do, virtually impossible to do. You need 2/3 of the House, 2/3 of the Senate. You think 60 is hard? Try to get 67 votes on anything. And then 3/4 of the state legislators have to approve. You need 38 states. Texas and Massachusetts have to agree together. It's very unlikely, it's very rare, unless there's widespread agreement. And you know what? I'm okay with that constitutional structure. I get it. When it comes to things like, oh, I don't know, equal protection under the laws, I don't want the majority to decide that a minority can't have equal rights. I want the court, when it rules on free speech, to decide that you can't burn a flag. I'm sorry, that you can burn a flag and you can't go to prison for burning a flag, even if the majority thinks you should. There are certain basic principles, many of them are in the Bill of Rights, that cannot be overruled unless you change the Constitution or get a new justice in there, get a new person in there, change the composition of the court. One person dies or retires, bingo, you got a new vote. That's why this is such a rare and important time when you replace a Supreme Court justice. Because you could actually change constitutional law. The Citizens United case, a lot of it was based on constitutional law. The claim that corporations have First Amendment rights to freedom of speech, even though corporations are nowhere in the Constitution. Why? Because the court found that corporations are persons, legal persons. And therefore, they have the rights that persons have under the Constitution, even though there's nothing in the Constitution that says corporations are persons. They just said it was so. In other words, if I could declare a dog a person, which frankly, a dog is much more like a person than a corporation. I mean, dogs can roll over. People can roll over. Dogs can bark. People can bark. Right? Dogs can show their happiness to see you. So can people. I don't think a corporation can do any of that. Dogs eat. Dogs copulate. Dogs sleep. They're far more like people than corporations are. I say if corporations are people, dogs are people. We should give them a right to vote. But this ridiculousness, this lawlessness, this craziness is the law in our country because five radical right-wing judicial activists said so. You see, it's one thing to interpret the law of Congress. It's quite another to use the Constitution to overrule the elected branches. That should be something that's done very rarely and only in cases where the minority definitely needs to be protected. That's why I believe in judicial restraint. And that's why I think Republicans who claim to believe in judicial restraint are hypocrites unless they support justices like John Paul Stevens, justices that generally found for the elected branches and didn't overrule their work. Toll-free number, 888-6-LESLIE, 888-653-7543. Give me your thoughts. Or I'm just going to go in and tell you when I took down Justice Scalia in person before a live audience. That's right, we did some legal judo. And guess who won? Story after the break.
Leslie Marshall, the simple truth in a complicated world. 888-6-LESLIE. If you miss Leslie on TV this week, catch up at LeslieMarshallShow.com.
Welcome back. Welcome back to the Leslie Marshall Show. This is Mark Levine, your second favorite talk show host. Leslie is gone. I am here. Like it or lump it. I hope you do like it. And if you lump it, well, then yeah, give me a call. Tell me why. If you disagree with anything I'm saying tonight, or if you agree, let me know. The toll-free number is 888-6-LESLIE, 888-653-7543. Two people who listen to The Inside Scoop, my toll-free number will get you there, too. 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. However it is, I want to tell you about my little run-in with Justice Scalia. You know, and I'm getting there. It takes me some time to get there. I'll get there, but I'm often asked, because I've now been on the O'Reilly Show four times. I've been on MSNBC. I have confronted Laura Ingraham. I've confronted Bill O personally several times. Well, don't you ever get nervous confronting them? I really don't. And I'm not just saying this to brag. I guess I don't because they're human. They're often wrong. And after going up against Justice Scalia, I'm not worried anymore about a legal argument or any other kind of argument with any conservative. Because Justice Scalia is considered the intellectual heavyweight on the court. He's considered the man that liberals need to contend with. It's often said that we need a liberal heavyweight, someone like Justice Stevens, or maybe something like Harvard Law Professor Lawrence Tribe, a real strong liberal legal mind to take on the likes of Scalia, because Scalia is known to be loud and caustic, but more importantly, to be someone who has a very strong judicial philosophy, so they say. Someone who firmly believes, so he says, in strict constructionism, firmly believes in the literal text of the United States Constitution, so he says. And therefore, it's hard to fight him. It's hard to fight with a strict constructionist. Well, the argument is partly right. It is hard to fight with a strict constructionist. It is hard to fight to someone who says, I believe the law says what it says and means what it says. if the law says this, it means that. If the law says you got to be 35 years old to be president, you got to be 35 years old to be president. Done. If the law says you can't soldier, you can't quarter soldiers in your home, you can't quarter soldiers in your home. You just can't. If the law says you can't search or spy on someone without a warrant, well, you can't. I know there are exceptions and all kinds of things, but the best way to reason the Constitution, I think, is to look at its literal language. I agree with what Justice Scalia says, but I don't agree with the way it comes out. Because, ladies and gentlemen, Justice Antonin Scalia, the legal heavyweight on the Supreme Court, the conservative icon, is, wait for it, a hypocrite. That's right. A blooming hypocrite. He claims to believe in the literal language of the Constitution. He claims to respect those words. But when those words conflict with his own conservative right-wing political philosophy, the Constitution is the first thing to go out the window. And I know that not just because I've analyzed his opinions, and we'll go through that, because I think it's important for you to understand his reasoning and real legal reasoning from a real strict constructionist, namely me, a liberal strict constructionist. I believe in the literal language of the Constitution, frankly, far more than Justice Scalia ever does. So that you know you can follow when you see the confirmation hearings and understand some of these rulings. But more so you understand Scalia is not magic. He's not impossible to beat. He's not the heavyweight he claims to be. Just simply adhere to the language of the Constitution and you'll find it's very, very easy to out-talk, to out-argue Justice Scalia, because he's a hypocrite. If he actually believed in the language of the Constitution as it was written, he wouldn't be as conservative as he is. He couldn't have voted, for example, for the Citizens United case because corporations are not people and they're never declared people anywhere in the Constitution. You want to make them people? Pass a constitutional amendment. So when we come back from break, I'm going to tell you one of my favorite stories. It's been often told but can never be too often repeated. The time that I, while in law school, challenged a sitting justice of the Supreme Court before about 200 of my fellow law students. And I dare say I won the challenge, but I'm going to let you decide when we come back and I tell you the showdown between Mark Levine and Justice Antonin Scalia. We'll be right back with that infamous showdown right after this.
You're listening to The Leslie Marshall Show. Truth for all sides of the spectrum. 888-6-LESLIE. If you miss Leslie on TV this week, catch up at LeslieMarshallShow.com.
Welcome back to The Leslie Marshall Show. This is Mark Levine filling in for Leslie Marshall. About to tell you my, well, it's a little bit of bragging, but it's my favorite smackdown. I took down the intellectual heavyweight, the conservative heavyweight on the Supreme Court. And no, it wasn't in a mud wrestling match. So that would be interesting. He'd probably beat me in a mud wrestling match. I suspect Scalia might bite. I don't know. But it was an intellectual, of course, match. And this is when I was at Yale Law School. And one of the nice things about being a law student is that you don't have to worry about offending a Supreme Court justice. That's a big advantage. You see, once you are a lawyer practicing before the United States Supreme Court, well, you got to be nice. You want your client to win the case. You may strongly disagree with Antonin Scalia, but you can't quite tell him off, can you? Because, that would look bad. But as a student, you have anyone could tell off the Supreme Court. President Obama, frankly, did a very good job of the State of the Union speech. He should have been stronger, I think, on the corporations are better than humans case, the Citizens United case. But you can get your megaphone out and complain about the Supreme Court as you want. But law students are in a better position to understand the Supreme Court decisions. But once you become a lawyer, well, again, you're kind of muzzled because, you know, you don't want to hurt your practice. But a law student, well, you can say pretty much whatever you want. Famously, recently, a law student asked asked Justice Scalia if he'd had oral sex with his wife. Now, this may seem an impertinent, scandalous question. In fact, the law school, to my dismay, actually turned off the student's mic, his microphone, which I think was wrong. It was a fair question. Why was it a fair question? Because Justice Scalia held in the Bowers v. Hardwick case that it is perfectly reasonable to put people who commit sodomy in jail for 20 years. What is sodomy? Oral sex. Oral or anal sex. But oral sex is part of sodomy. And it includes, by the way, the statute in Georgia, it includes oral sex between husband and wife. That's right. Antonin Scalia thinks that if you have oral sex with your spouse, your heterosexual spouse, you can be put in jail for 20 years. He's okay with that. I'm not. He is. So the law student asked him the very important question of whether he was basically doing the thing that he felt was perfectly constitutional to put someone in jail for 20 years. And the student was considered so impertinent they cut off his microphone. Like I said, I disagree. For Justice Scalia, it's a very fair question. I did not have my microphone cut off. I, back in the early 90s, was arguing with Justice Scalia. He appeared before us, and I give him credit for one thing. Scalia is willing to go before a group of skeptical law students and state his views, and I give him credit for that, because if you truly believe your point of view, political, legal, whatever it is, and you're willing to defend it against all comers, well, I give you get props for that. I'm willing to do it. I think anyone who truly believes what they say is willing to do it. And, you know, Justice Thomas, he would do that in a million years. I don't think he has the intellectual heft, or maybe he just doesn't have the democratic appreciation for the fact that his fellow citizens may disagree with him. But Scalia, to his credit, came before a group of law students, including myself, proudly wielding his Constitution, and was asked question after question after question. And with virtually every question he was asked, he would whip out his Constitution, read a phrase or two from it, declare the matter simple and closed, and with a laugh, move on. I remember when a student asked him about the Second Amendment. Now, this is before Justice Scalia determined that the whole militia clause in there didn't mean anything. And we may, if we have time, I'll talk about the Second Amendment. That's the one that gun nuts say protects an individual right to bear arms, but which, from the text of it, simply protects your right to be in a militia. But that's not the focus of my story. The only point is that when someone asked Justice Scalia about the right to bear arms, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, they said, well, Justice Scalia, clearly there are limits to this right. Clearly there are limits to this right. You can't expect a government to allow every human being, every American citizen, to have a nuclear warhead. So Justice Scalia smiled his wicked smile and flipped through his Constitution with glee and said, the right of the people to keep and bear arms. What does it mean to bear arms? Bear means to carry, from the Latin for whatever bear means in Latin. Bear means bear arms is to carry arms. Can you carry a rifle? You can. Can you carry a handgun? You can. Can you carry a nuclear warhead? No, you cannot. They're too heavy. Next question. Well, everybody laughed. Laughed at the hypertextual nature, the hyperliteral nature of Justice Scalia's read on the Constitution. Of course, today you probably could pick up a nuclear suitcase, a dirty bomb. People are very much afraid of that. And, of course, there's all kinds of very nasty weapons that you can hide, that you can carry. Anthrax, perhaps, comes to mind. Sarin gas, a whole bunch of stuff. Anyway, he got his laugh. Throughout, he kept talking about the Latin for this means this, and the Constitution clearly means this, and it obviously means that, and therefore I'm right. Next question. So then it was my turn to ask a question. And I raised my hand and I said, Scalia, I want to ask you about the Ninth Amendment to the Constitution. That may not be one you're familiar with. I didn't say that to him. I'm saying that to you. You may know the Bill of Rights backwards and forwards, but you may not. The Ninth Amendment says the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights should not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. Sounds like a pretty technical amendment. But I knew that the source of much of the things that Scalia hated, the right to privacy, The one that protects a woman's right to choose whether or not to have a baby. The one that says that you can't ban contraception. The same right that would later be held to say you can't put someone in jail for having a kind of consensual sex that you don't like. It's the kind that protects our private freedoms to do what we want with consensual adults in our own homes. I knew Scalia hated this amendment, so I wanted to understand how he interpreted it. And I went through it word by word with him. And you'll hear exactly how he responded when we come back after break. 888-6-LESLIE, 888-653-7543. Right back after this.
Leslie Marshall, straight and on point. 888-6-LESLIE. Listen to Leslie while you're surfing the web. Visit www.lesliemarshallshow.com and click on the Hear Leslie microphone to hear the show streaming.
Welcome back to the Leslie Marshall Show. This is Mark Levine filling in for Leslie Marshall, your second favorite talk show host. And I've been talking about it for the last 2 hours. I'm going to finally give you the conclusion to my story. When, yes, I took on Justice Scalia personally on a question of constitutional law and lived to tell the story. So some of this requires a little bit of legal context, but I actually think it's not that hard to understand. I asked Justice Scalia about the Ninth Amendment to the Constitution, which reads, "The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people." Pretty self-explanatory. Just because we name certain rights in the Constitution, that doesn't mean we don't have other rights. That's very clearly what the Ninth Amendment says. So I said to Justice Scalia, "What do you think about the Ninth Amendment?" And he said, "The Ninth Amendment is merely precatory." Precatory is that one of those wonderful legal words that, you know, you pay lawyers to use. Precatory means advisory. It's just a suggestion. The Constitution was amended just as a suggestion. So I said, "Justice Scalia, the Ninth Amendment isn't, you know, part of the original Constitution. It was an amendment. It was a change from the prior Constitution. It required 2/3 of the House and the Senate, required 3/4 of state legislatures. It was an amendment. Why would they go all the trouble to amend the Constitution just to give advice to future generations?" He said, "Read the text. It's just advisory." He starts flipping through his pocket Constitution. "First Amendment, Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion." Shall. Shall is mandatory. "Second Amendment, well-regulated militia be necessary to secure a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed." Shall, that's mandatory. But what about the Ninth Amendment, he says. "The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed." I said, "Shall!" I interrupted Justice Scalia. I said, "Shall! The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people." The Ninth Amendment, I said, is as mandatory as all the others. He said, "But wait, let me finish. Let me finish. The enumeration of the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people." This, Scalia said, is merely to remind legislators, be careful of the people's rights when you pass laws. I said, "Justice Scalia, I am clearly not the Latin scholar that you are." I remember saying those exact words. That's why I can still remember to this day, almost 20 years later. "Justice Scalia, I'm not the Latin scholar that you are, but construed, that word, that doesn't seem to apply to legislators at all. Legislatures don't construe laws. Congress does not construe laws. Congress passes laws. Congress repeals laws. Congress amends laws. Congress can do whatever it damn well pleases with laws." I didn't use the word damn. Not in front of Justice Scalia. "But the point is that Congress makes the laws. They can change them. They can abolish them. They don't construe them." "Construe," I said to Justice Scalia, "doesn't construe mean interpret. If you construe something, you interpret it. And isn't it," I said, citing the most famous constitutional case in American jurisprudence, Marbury versus Madison, "is it not the province of the courts to interpret the law? If the courts interpret the courts construe the law. And if the law shall not be construed, isn't this, Justice Scalia, a restriction on your power? if it says you cannot construe laws to deny or disparage other rights retained by the people, then this doesn't apply to legislatures. They don't construe laws. This doesn't apply to the president. This applies to you, Justice Scalia. You interpret the laws. I got a standing ovation. Lots of cheers. All the students were very proud of me for beating Scalia in an argument. But Scalia said, no, wait. Okay, fine. But should not be the enumeration of the Constitution of certain rights should not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. It doesn't say what others. It doesn't say what the other rights are. It doesn't mean anything, Justice Scalia said, of an amendment to the Constitution, part of the Bill of Rights. It doesn't mean anything, Justice Scalia said. It's impossible to interpret. And I said, Justice Scalia, others retained by the people, retained. What does that word mean? It means kept. It means that the enumeration in the Constitution, the fact that we are numbering, that we are dictating rights, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, that we are saying things in the Constitution, shall not be construed. In other words, you, court, don't construe them this way. Just because we name certain rights doesn't mean there aren't other rights that the people have. And Justice Scalia said, well, what other rights could they be? I said, those retained by the people. Those that the people had at the time the United States became a country. The common law. Dictums such as a man's home is his castle, which had been English common law for centuries before the United States was formed. In other words, the right to privacy. If a man's home is his castle, he has the right to privacy. At which point, Justice Scalia said, all right now, you've asked enough questions. Let's go on to someone else. And the crowd cheered, and they said, answer his question, answer his question, answer his question. And Justice Scalia said, no, I need to move on to someone else. I'm very proud of that moment. You may think the Ninth Amendment is... Thank you, Mike. It's actually one of the most proud moments in my life. That's one of the reasons why I remember it so clearly.
That's a pretty good story, I'd have to say. I would be proud of it myself.
I'm very proud of it, because here I took a constitutional right, one that protects a lot of the rights that liberals enjoy, things like Roe v. Wade, things like the right of adults to have protections, freedoms in their own home, the right to privacy. I gave it firm grounding in the Constitution, and he ran away from the argument, even though I was true to the text, and Scalia was not. So Scalia may be an intellectual heavyweight. I don't know. I just think his bark is worse than his bite. Tear it apart and it makes no sense. Just like if you tear apart the Bush v. Gore decision, you see there's nothing there. The emperor has no clothes. It's not based in law. It's based solely in politics. And every single lawyer worth his or her salt knows it. It's the reason why there is not a single conservative jurist who has ever defended the logic of Bush v. Gore. They can't. There is no logic in it. They can say, I'm glad Bush is president. They can say, as some have said, well, it was difficult, and I'm glad the Supreme Court took over, blah, blah, blah. None of them will defend the logic of the decision, because there is no logic in the decision. When it comes to the Constitution and logic versus Scalia wanting to ram his views down America's throats, he throws away the Constitution and logic. I want a Supreme Court justice that will do at the very, very least what I did as a third-year law student with Justice Scalia. I can give you other examples, too. The Second Amendment, I argued that with Bill O'Reilly. You can get that on my website, by the way, radioinsidescoop.com, when I show Bill O'Reilly. Of course, he only gives me about 30 seconds, that obviously the Second Amendment protects militias and not an individual right to bear arms. Ask me some other time. I'll be happy. I'll be on Wednesday, by the way. I'm filling in for Leslie Wednesday, too. If you call and ask, I will be happy to tell you why the Second Amendment does not protect an individual right to bear arms. That takes a lengthy argument, just as I gave before. I'll give that to you. Or my second run-in with Justice Scalia before a small audience where I dare say I beat him again in the logical argument. But we don't have time for that tonight, because in my third hour, I'm going to talk with an expert of everything West Virginia, an expert into the coal mines. And I do want to get to my caller who's been patiently waiting. Dave from Bayside, California. Welcome to Leslie Marshall Show.
Hey, Mark, congratulations on your encounter with Justice Scalia there. This is the day that used to be with you for years when you were head on Radio Network.
Yes.
Awfully good to be hearing you again, Mark.
Yes, and Dave, Bob Kincaid of the Head on Radio Network is going to be on in the next hour, so it's a reunion of sorts. It is good to hear from you.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I think the world of him, too. I didn't know whatever became of you and head-on.
Well, I decided to pursue other pastures. If you go to my website, you haven't been there in a while, I guess, but go to RadioInsideScoop.com, and you will see I've been tangling with O'Reilly and Laura Ingraham. I've been on Fox News a lot. I've been on MSNBC, CNBC. And by the way, and I think I can announce it here, starting a week from Wednesday, I'm going to be on Fox News every single morning at 9:30 a.m. Eastern Time. You in California, you have to get up at 6:30 a.m. or tape it. But it looks like this is in the works, and, well, you've just encouraged me to announce it. So I've moved on to greener pastures. Nothing wrong with my friends at Head On, but I'm doing other things. Now, what's your question about the Supreme Court?
Well, it's my hope that Barack Obama could appoint for us another William O. Douglas, who I believe was somebody that you held in very high regard. What we need is a judge who would be motivated to act sincerely in the interests of the people, particularly the have-not people. We, I think, have so much right now, a government owned completely by big special interests that find ways to control us electronically and radio-wise and everything.
Well, and in fact, one of the rulings of the Supreme Court just recently, a really terrible ruling, which I'm sure you're aware of, Dave, maybe some listeners aren't, is a ruling about internet neutrality. Now, internet neutrality means that a content provider, someone like Comcast, who brings you your internet to you through your cable bill, through your cable cord, cannot control your content. It makes sense. It's a regulation right now put forward by the FCC, by the Federal Communications Commission, that says, you know what, you can't censor people. You can't do what China does. You can't say, oh, you can't watch that movie, or, oh, you can't get that political thing, or, oh, we at Comcast are going to make our website load 100 times quicker than the rival Verizon because we don't want you going over to them. None of that. You can't discriminate.
Our government does it to us, Bob.
Well, exactly. What the Supreme Court just held recently is that the Federal Communications Commission, which you would think would have the power to regulate communications, that's what they do, that actually they don't have the power to regulate the internet, at least based on current regulations. So now we're going to have a law, or we're going to have an executive order or something to do that. But this is exactly the kind of radical right-wing court we have on issues big and small, on issues big like Bush v. Gore, Citizens United, even issues small like the internet. This court is all about taking away your freedoms, things that conservatives usually are trying.
Mark, I should be flattered because I've been virtually locked out of every chat room. I was a rare exception to be able to get on your own because you required no passwords and no codes.
That's
right
true.
Right now, I have been blocked out of Radio Inside Scoop for the last year or so.
I don't know why that would be so. Dave, send me an email, Mark, M-A-R-K, at RadioInsideScoop.com. Along with your email address. I don't know why that would be the case. I certainly have not done it. I assure you of that.
No, I know you didn't. I know you didn't. They've given me long code words and passwords, the same reason I can't get on with Bob Kincaid. I wish I could get back to you during the hour when you have him on.
Well, I tell you, I'm going to have him on in the next hour. So all you have to do is tune into your radio or whatever you're listening to, the internet, right now, and you will hear my interview with him. We're going to talk about West Virginia. We're going to talk about the evil that is the Massey Energy Corporation and what we
can
do to stop
these people.
Good to
hear you again, Mark. You're live here in Eureka, Humboldt, Carroll.
I'm glad I am, Dave. I'm sorry. My time's up for the hour, but stay tuned. We're going to talk about the West Virginia mining. I want to thank you for your call, Dave. Encourage you to call in again. And next up, Bob Kincaid giving all the details of the horror in West Virginia. At the top of the hour, back after this.
You're listening to The Leslie Marshall Show. Truth for all sides of the spectrum. 888-6-LESLIE. The Leslie Marshall Show, a true democracy in talk radio. Of, for, and by you, the people.
Love it. Mark, does Leslie know that you take out her I'm a Woman song and put it I'm a Man?
No, actually.
Is this a secret just between you and me and all
did,
our listeners?
To be honest, I made this a long time ago when I filled in with her because as with you, I'm a man. So it's kind of like weird to come in with this open
I'm a woman.
Woman,
exactly.
You know? So I'm like, all right, how can I? And I thought of that song and it was perfect, but I couldn't just flip it. So I just thought of, oh, what about like a record scratch?
That's
so, yeah,
funny. That's really
kind of
funny.
A little backdoor.
All right, that's our secret. Now, listeners, right. Don't tell Leslie, you know, that you do this here. Hey, this is Mark Levine filling in for Leslie Marshall. Very, very glad to be here. I do want to correct something I said last hour by mistake. I think I got a little too excited. I am on Fox every Wednesday morning. That's going to be the schedule starting April 21st. I'll be on at 9:30 Eastern Time, so that's 8:30 Central, 7:30 Mountain, 6:30 Pacific Time. I will go into the Lion's Den, but only on Wednesdays, and I'll debate, you know, some Republican they pick, and the host, of course, because, you know, all the Fox hosts are way out right-wingers. It'll be 2-1, and you can see me hold my own. If you want to see, I did one this morning. It's on my website, radioinsidescoop.com, when I argue that we shouldn't be calling our terrorist Islamic extremists. We should leave Islam out of it. So check that out. And starting Wednesday the 21st, I'm actually going to ask liberal people for 5 minutes only to turn on Fox News. But now let me get to my guest, because my guest who's on the line, Bob Kincaid, is someone I used to work with on the Head On Radio Network. He is a radio host of his own on that network. And he's someone who really understands what he calls the hills and hollers of West Virginia, I think better, well, than anyone in America. He's lived there a very long time. And for a very long time, long before this accident, he has been decrying the Massey Energy Corporation, talking about mountaintop removal. That's basically where they take dynamite and blow the tops off mountains, spreading arsenic and selenium and all kinds of pollutants into West Virginia rivers. He's been talking about miner safety. He's been talking about the fact that the Massey Energy Corporation doesn't allow unionization, and doing it long before this accident, which I think Bob Kincaid will tell you, sadly, was all too predictable. Bob Kincaid, welcome to the Leslie Marshall Show.
Well, Mark, good evening. Thank you for inviting me aboard.
It's always good to have you, particularly on such an issue. I'll tell you, when this happened, I dare say most of us who live outside of West Virginia who hadn't heard you speak before, many Americans were surprised. They talked about the fact that, you know, there was an accident that killed 29 miners. Would you call it an accident?
This is in no wise an accident, Mark. This is just, this is another sad chapter in the ongoing legacy of blood and death and misery and agony that is chapter and verse of the Appalachian apocalypse.
Wow. Apocalypse. Pretty extreme.
Yes.
Tell me what has been going on.
It's a horror that's been ongoing for over 125 years now.
And it's the horror of coal mining.
Yes. In the past century, Mark, over 104,000 human beings have died in Appalachian coal mines.
104,000. Wow.
This year and last year and next year, 1,000 miners will die.
But, Bob, on the news they were talking about it was 29. It was the most extreme accident since one in 1970. What is the mainstream media missing here?
Well, what I'm getting at is, these periodic disasters get the attention of the mainstream media, but three miners a day in this country, Mark, die from black lung disease.
The slow death rather than the quick death.
Pardon?
The slow death rather than the quick death.
Yes, slow and miserable, in which your lungs literally become carbonized.
And that's from breathing in coal dust?
Yes. And now, it is largely preventable now, but it is not prevented because you have scofflaw companies like Massey that manipulate pre-existing regulations because they find it not suitable to their profit motive.
So how would you prevent the coal dust from getting in your lungs and it killing you? Some kind of gas mask, something like that?
Sure. There's masking and there's industrial curtaining. There's any number of technologies that are specifically designed to keep that from happening.
And is it just too expensive for the Massey Energy Corporation to protect its workers?
Oh, Massey Energy has no interest in protecting its workers. Massey Energy has accountants who have figured out that it's cheaper to lose the workers than it is to lose the profit.
Yeah, I noticed that Don Blankenship, the CEO of Massey, said he was going to pay for the funerals. And I remember thinking, oh, you know, how generous of you.
That is one of the most noxious, most sickening statements that I've ever seen. It should, decency demands, Mark, that Massey shouldn't even have to say that. It should be taken as read.
Tell me,
Bob. That they would pay for the funerals. I can't see. What does Massey expect to gain?
Public relations,
we're so
right?
Generous. We're going to pay for the funerals.
Oh my God.
For the deaths that we caused.
Tell me this, Bob, because I think some people may get the idea that you are for immediate banning of all coal mining. Is that true?
No, it isn't. I understand that. I recognize that there is a need for legitimate underground coal mining in this country. There are certain things that can't be done without coal. One of them is the making of steel. And that's the kind of coal that was coming out of this mine at Upper Big Branch. But the problem, Mark, is that Massey's major market initiative was not for metallurgical coal that would go to rebuild the American economy or get America working again. No. That was coal that was bound for China and India.
Really? So the West Virginia coal that Americans are dying for doesn't even go to America?
In large part, no. It goes literally around the world on a freighter, and in the steelmaking process, it comes back and winds up in your local Wally World as some piece of the miserable steel junk.
Tell me, maybe this.
It's a lawnmower housing that was $50 less expensive than an American one.
Bob, when you read these stories out of rural West Virginia, and there's a whole bunch of them now, and I realize that you deal with this every day, but for those of us who live outside Appalachia, it is when these disasters occur. That's when the New York Times, that's when the Washington Post writes about it. And you read the stories of, frankly, miserable lives in your neck of the woods, people who don't see any other decent paying job other than working in the coal mines. There is no other work. You know, they might try, the article said in the Washington Post today, this guy tried automotive maintenance for a few years, but it seemed that the only job they could find that made a living in West Virginia was the coal mines.
That's not accidental, Mark.
Okay, tell me about that.
You're an economist. You're economically trained.
Yes.
You know what a mono economy is.
Explain to our listeners what a mono economy is.
A mono economy is an economic model that is predicated on the existence of only one means of employment and of making money.
What people used to call the company town.
Well, exactly. The only thing is, in Appalachia, the mono economy is coal. And frankly, the coal industry doesn't want other industry coming in because I've been to West Virginia.
I went.
It's stranglehold on the work.
Bob, I went whitewater rafting. In fact, I think some of the best whitewater rafting in the world is in West Virginia on the Gauley River, not too far from you. There are West Virginia happens to have beautiful mountains and trees. I would think environmentalists, whether it's whitewater rafting or just hiking, fishing, if the waters were clean, there's a lot of other things you could do in West Virginia, right?
It's an exquisite state. What's left of it? It's a beautiful state. What's left of it, but mining touches every aspect of it, and especially, and I think this is what's important to discuss, Mark, is that the tragedy that we saw at Upper Big Branch was not the disease. It is a symptom of a much larger disease, because when you consider what happens in West Virginia and in Appalachia with mining, you know, for instance, you're right, not too far from where I live is a burgeoning, growing tourism industry. But that tourism industry is threatened by the fact that there was a mountaintop removal job within 2 miles of those magnificent roaring rivers you mentioned.
You know, I've always thought that mountaintop removal was too nice a way to describe what is literally explosions of an order of magnitude larger than Hiroshima. It just, I don't know, mountaintop removal almost sounds like you sort of cart away a little bit of dirt. Tell our listeners what mountaintop removal really entails.
Thank you, Mark. Every day in West Virginia, 3.5 million, that's million with an M, pounds of high explosives are used to blow away the mountains in order to get at thin seams of coal beneath as much as 800 feet from the top. That's 3.5 million pounds of the same explosives that Timothy McVeigh used on the Murrah Federal Building. It poisons the water. It poisons the air. It buries the streams. The mountains can never be brought back to what they were.
You know, I've seen those mountains. Bob has shown me pictures.
Communities and kills people.
Bob has shown me pictures. It looks like a moonscape. It literally looks like these beautiful mountains of West Virginia, and I've been there. And if you've never been there, it's a really beautiful rural state if you like mountains the way I do. But what they've done is they've taken these beautiful mountains and trees and birds and streams and all of that and made it into, frankly, something that looks less habitable than the moon. The moon looks
It really does have to be seen to be believed, Mark. And a great place to go and have a look is crmw.net. That's the homepage of a grassroots organization down in the same area as where the Upper Big Branch disaster took place, called Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. You can learn about horrors like, the Marsh Fork Elementary School, where all the press was gathered.
I tell you what, you're going to have to hold that point, Bob, because we have to go to a commercial break. But I want to hear about the school, and I also want to hear about some of the union busting that Massey has done. And I also want to hear from you if you have a question for Bob about real life in West Virginia mining towns. Give us a call, 888-6-LESLIE, 888-653-7543. We'll be right back after this.
Want to hear that hour again? Just go to LeslieMarshallShow.com to download a free podcast of Leslie.
Welcome back to the Leslie Marshall Show. This is Mark Levine filling in for Leslie Marshall. Very glad to be here. We're talking about the West Virginia mine disaster, but more than that, because the mine disaster was news, perhaps, to all of Americans living outside of Appalachia. But for people like my guest, Bob Kincaid, who's a talk radio host on the Head On Radio Network and a longtime resident of West Virginia, this mine so-called accident not only was not an accident, it wasn't really news. This is the kind of stuff that's been going on, as Bob points out, for more than 100 years and continues today. Bob, welcome back to the show. You were telling me about the Marshfield Elementary School.
Yes, Marsh Fork Elementary. That's where, as people watched all over the country, Mark, and saw the reporters doing their stand-ups at the little school there, not too far from the mine site, that's Marsh Fork Elementary School. And very little was actually said by the mainstream media, and it frankly must be said because it's intolerable to even contemplate this. That school sits within 100 yards of a toxic coal preparation plant run by Massey Energy, okay? Now, you really didn't see it, but behind the school runs the Little Coal River. And if you look up the mountain, or what used to be a mountain, actually what used to be a valley, if you look up about, 400-800 feet or so, what that is, it looks strange, but what it is it's a dirt and rock dam, if you can imagine. It is a dam, just like a dam that would hold back a river or anything, made of dirt and rocks. And behind that dam, Mark, are 2.8 billion, with a B, gallons of toxic waste.
Now, that's coal sludge?
Yeah, coal sludge.
And what is toxic about coal sludge? Well, what is coal sludge and what's toxic about it?
Coal is treated prior to being shipped out to reduce dust, to reduce impurities, to wash away, but to clear away things that aren't coal. And what's left over after that is either pumped into old coal mines or it's put behind these dirt dams that dot southern West Virginia. For instance, that's 2.8 billion gallons, and it contains arsenic and selenium and a whole butcher's bill laundry list of poisons that get into the groundwater and literally poison people who have no idea that they're being poisoned. There are people in southern West Virginia who have wells. And if you think, Mark, about the historical importance of wells, think about how wells are treated in the Bible, for instance.
You need water.
How sacred they are.
Sure.
Well, you've got people in Appalachia who have wells, whose wells have been poisoned by Massey Energy, And when they turn on their faucets in their kitchens, this stinking stuff that smells like rotten eggs come out of the faucet, and it looks like tomato soup.
And there's a school that's behind, I guess what you might call a levee if you lived in New Orleans, only I don't know that this is even as sturdy as the ones
in New
Orleans.
Well, they like to call them impoundments, Mark.
Okay. It's just a dam.
Yeah, it's a toxic waste dam.
And is there fear it's going to collapse and drown the school?
That particular dam behind Marsh Fork Elementary is leaking at the toe, Mark.
Wow. So it's already
now,
leaking.
And here's where, and it's not isolated. If you go down the road toward Whitesville a little bit more, you come upon, and you're not supposed to see these things, but if you fly over, you certainly can. There's something called the Brushy Fork Impoundment. Now, everybody knows about Hoover Dam, right? I mean, biggest dam in the Western Hemisphere.
Sure.
No, it isn't.
Really?
Biggest dam in the Western Hemisphere is the Brushy Fork Impoundment, and it holds back 9.8 billion gallons of toxic waste. And the engineering reports of Massey Energy itself say that when that dam breaks, because all things man-made fail, when that dam breaks, 1,000 human beings die immediately, and Whitesville, West Virginia, is inundated by an onrushing wall of toxic waste between 40 and 60 feet high.
9.8 billion
gallons.
There
aren't any buildings in Whitesville that are 40 or 60 feet high.
That's bigger than many reservoirs of many cities.
Yes.
And it's just full of, you know, it's funny because we often talk about nuclear waste, and gosh knows I'm not defending nuclear waste, but the sheer quantity of this coal sludge vastly, vastly outnumbers any amount of nuclear waste in the whole country.
And that's just two. There's a dozen more.
Okay, Bob, we have to take another break at the half hour. But when we come back, I'm going to ask you a really difficult question. My question is, why doesn't anybody do something about it? And I'm going to propose to you possible solutions. I know you know the answers, but I'm going to just give it to you before the break so you can think about it. One, we know lawyers. Why not just a massive class action to clean it up? Number two, why not West Virginia politicians? Why aren't they doing the work? Number three, how's the Obama administration doing? How did the Bush administration do? You and I always seek political, real-life, practical solutions to problems. What can be done? What should be done to help out West Virginia? Folks, if you want any questions, this guy, Bob Kincaid, knows everything about West Virginia and coal mining. Give us a call, 888-6-LESLIE, 888-653-7543. We'll be right back with Bob Kincaid right after this.
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of truth. The Leslie Marshall Show, 888-6-LESLIE. Sign up for our free newsletter. Go to www.leslymarshallshow.com.
Welcome back to the Leslie Marshall Show. This is Mark Levine having the distinct honor and privilege of filling in for Leslie Marshall. And it's my particular privilege to bring in my guest today, someone I've worked with in the past on the Head On Radio Network, someone who really knows West Virginia better than anyone I know. And it is very clear on the fact that the disasters in the mines have happened long before the current mine disaster you hear about in all the news. Bob, before the break, I was asking the difficult question of what to do about it. So let me just ask you, solution by solution that come to my mind, and why at least so far they haven't worked. First of all, the law. Why can't some enterprising lawyer, and I'm a big fan of trial lawyers, being an ex-trial lawyer myself, bring a massive class action and say they're poisoning our wells, they're killing us with black lung, they're destroying our villages. Massey, pay for it.
Mark, I can't say that it's a class action as such, but there is litigation like what you're describing underway relating to a community in West Virginia in which people have been literally poisoned by the foul substances that Massey has allowed by virtue of their mountaintop removal operations and their sludge injection and their sludge dams have allowed to get into people's water supplies. That is underway.
And so is this new litigation, or it's been around for a while?
It's less than 2 years old.
Okay. And so do you have high hopes for this, or is the law against you here?
I would, right now, I'd say it's a coin toss.
Really? And that's because of judges or juries or the law or all three?
It's all three, and it's being tried right there in the heart of the coal fields. And frankly, you're going to be hard. I don't know how you'll get a jury on it.
Because the jury, many of them know of the dangers and yet still are willing to work in the mines, much like I suppose child labor was back 100 years ago, where the 9-year-olds were put in the plants and the parents said, hey, we need the money. You know, don't try to protect my 9-year-old from me. Is it similar to that?
Mark, just to give you an idea of the death grip that Massey and the coal industry at large hold on southern West Virginia, I drive down the road and I see billboards that say, coal, yes, coal, and then underneath it the slogan, clean, carbon neutral, coal.
Carbon neutral. Now, I'm not a chemist, but isn't coal carbon?
Consider the Spanish word for coal, carbon.
Okay, that's a good
carbon
sign.
Carbon
neutral carbon. Carbon without carbon.
Fat-free lard.
Fat-free lard. There you
LP
go.
Cigarettes.
There you go. Okay. Yeah, nicotine and tar-free cigarettes, I guess. So carbon neutral carbon. But no one really believes that, do they?
Yes, they do. Yes, they do.
In West Virginia,
outdated. I couldn't. You know that I am a fan of the West Virginia Mountaineers.
I do.
Naturally, I watched the basketball team's fantastic run toward the championship that fell sadly short. But I couldn't even sit and enjoy my alma mater's basketball team without being inundated with commercials telling me that Massey Energy is good for West Virginia.
But here's the problem when you got the one company town, Bob, and you also have, we haven't talked about this yet, but the unions run out of town by Massey Energy. Maybe just briefly tell us about the fights about unionization with Massey.
Well, okay, to go back in history a little bit, my great-grandfather, there are about 9 or 10 generations of my family in West Virginia now, but
wow.
My great-grandfather and my grandfather struggled to bring a decent living, a decent wage, and a decent way of life to their families by organizing via the United Mine Workers of America.
Okay.
They succeeded. In years later, about 1985, Don Blankenship, who had taken the helm of Massey Energy, Don Blankenship broke the UMWA like a dry twig over his knee, using practices that were arguably illegal, but for which there was little or no defense. You remember this is the middle of the Reagan 80s.
Sure, right. They didn't protect labor
at
all then.
The Reagan Justice Department or the Reagan administration itself was going to lift a finger to help a working man.
Right.
Just to give you an idea of what kind of a human being you're dealing with in Don Blankenship, he cut his teeth, Mark, back when he was breaking the UMWA. He cut his teeth doing business with the apartheid regime in South Africa.
Nice.
With literally slave coal mining there via Royal Dutch Shell.
Yes, sweet, sweet guy. But and so here's my question. It seems like the people of West Virginia, they're damned if they do, damned if they don't. They're clearly damned if they do, and you've described in terrific detail all the horrors and pollution and dangers of coal mining, the way it's currently practiced in West Virginia. But, Bob, I know there are people in West Virginia that say we're damned if we don't. It is a one-company town. If I want to continue to live here in this town that my father and my grandfather, like yours, and great-grandfather grew up in, this is the only business in town. What do you say to them?
The fact of the matter is, it's not the only business in town. We've talked about a tourism economy already.
That's true. That's true.
Two, even if it is the only business in town, that mandates that we find another business because it's a finite fossil fuel, and almost all of the responsible science says that the finite part of finite fossil fuel is becoming nearer and nearer and nearer. Central Appalachian coal is running out. It will be gone. And anyone knows, anyone who's ever seen an Old West ghost town with the tumbleweeds blowing through it, know that when the mining is gone, the towns dry up because the mining companies go away and they don't care. So it is incumbent upon the people who live there, who have heritage there, to address, frankly, a just transition to a coal-free future.
And
it
you've
really
talked about
simple.
You've talked about wind using those mountain.
I say something from time to time, Mark. I tell people we talk about how green we want to make America and we want a green economy. If you do not take strongly and primarily into account the greening of Appalachia, you can't green the rest of the country because the rest of the country will always be stained coal black if you let Appalachia continue to be this country's national sacrifice.
I can only speak for myself. I live near the Potomac River, which flows between Washington, D.C. and Virginia, and that river streams. Its headwaters are in West Virginia. So a lot of that pollution and arsenic and selenium gets in the rivers, and they have told us in no uncertain terms, I can't swim in the river that's very close to my home because it's toxic.
Imagine, Mark, over 1,000 miles of headwater streams in Appalachia have been buried by valley fills caused by mountaintop removal. Over 500 mountains have been blown away. They don't exist anymore. It's an area the size of the state of Delaware.
But you believe, Bob, that even during the short time there's still coal left in Appalachia, that there are safe ways to mine the coal without bombing the mountains, mountaintop removal, without having without having methane blowing up a mine as it did the Upper Big Mine. You think there are ways to do it. It just costs more. Is that right?
It doesn't even cost that much more. You have to simply care as much about the miner as you do about the coal. Kevin Strickland, an administrator for the Mine Safety and Health Administration, said early on during the development of the Upper Big Branch tragedy, all these explosions are preventable. When these things happen, it means something has been done wrong.
Massey famously had 1,342 safety violations over the last 5 years. I've done my calculations. There's only 1,900 days or so in 5 years. They had almost one violation a day, 50 in the last month, and it's been reported in the press, that it's exactly the things that blew up. In other words, fans blowing methane the wrong way. Oops.
And consider the gravity of that when you consider, Mark, that mine, Upper Big Branch, produced 2 million cubic yards of methane per day.
Wow. That's a lot of explosive gas.
No pun intended when I say that's breathtaking.
Yeah, and we know that the little man trips, the things, the electronic carts they take inside the mountain can easily have a spark, and if the air is 5% methane, boom. The whole mountain explodes, and of course, that's what happened here. Bob, we got to take one more break, but when we come back, I want to address specifically the question of politicians, both in West Virginia and at the national level, what they're doing, what they've done, what they could be doing if people listening to the sound of our voices were to take action. If you want to talk to Bob Kincaid or to me, here's your last chance to call in, 888-6-LESLIE, 888-653-7543, back after this.
Follow Leslie on Twitter. Just go to www.twitter.com/LeslieMarshall, and we'll be sure to share your tweets.
Welcome back. We've only got about 10 minutes left in the Leslie Marshall Show. This is Mark Levine filling in for Leslie Marshall with my incredible guest. He's Bob Kincaid. He's a radio host on the Head On Radio Network, and he's someone who can speak the truth. He's a ninth-generation West Virginian, and unlike most ninth-generation West Virginians, virtually all of whom are working in coal. Of course, Bob comes from a family of coal. Bob is willing to speak out. Sometimes I fear for his safety. And he's telling us about blowing up mountains, toxic dams with billions of dollars in sludge, threatening elementary schools, and, well, virtually nothing being done about it. Ken from Buffalo, welcome to the Leslie Marshall Show.
Hi, Mark.
Hello.
Hi, Bob. I have an idea about 20 miles away from Buffalo is Niagara Falls. And many years ago, there was a toxic area called Love Canal. And that area, I guess, was cleaned up. What would happen if the federal government took over a cleanup operation of all these toxic, poisonous leavings of the coal mines, and people would see both the cost of cleaning up these incredible polluted areas and the safety concerns, and besides all this talk about unemployment, they could put a lot of people to work on it.
Great question, Ken. Bob, what's the answer?
Ken, I'd love to see Appalachian stimulus like that. The fact of the matter is the coal companies are under legal mandate to clean up their own mess. They like to call it reclamation. I think it's mostly just a wreck. Only 3% of all mountaintop removal jobs in Appalachia have ever been reclaimed, and nothing. The biggest problem is that the whole idea of reclamation is a myth, because you cannot put back what it took the earth hundreds of millions of years to create. The Appalachians are the oldest mountains on earth. We can try to limit the damage and limit the harm, but I don't know that it can ever be reclaimed. What's most important is that we've lost 500 mountains. We've got to draw a line in the sand and absolutely demand that no more be destroyed.
Let me ask you about the federal government. Before I get there, though, I do want to ask you about your West Virginia government. I mean, after all, the entire state is mountainous, pretty much, maybe except for the northern panhandle. Why isn't West Virginia doing something about this problem?
Because West Virginia government is bought and paid for. It's a, Massey Energy's subsidiary, Performance Coal, was where the explosion was. And Performance Coal is a wholly owned subsidiary of Massey Energy. Well, West Virginia state government is a wholly owned subsidiary of the coal industry at large.
Okay, I get that. So let's go to the federal solution. Tell me what Bush did or didn't do, and tell me what Obama is doing or isn't doing.
Well, first of all, you may recall that the Bush administration had a penchant for clarifying things that were already pretty well clear.
That's
true.
The
Bush administration clarified the Clean Water Act by explaining to us that coal filth was no longer to be considered pollution, and it was okay by them to dump it in streams.
I see. So arsenic is no longer a poison, I guess, since that's coal filth.
But, you know, what would you expect from the same group that brought us the pollute the air more under the Clear Skies Initiative, cut down the trees under the Healthy Forests Initiative? You know, it was the eight most Orwellian years that the United States have ever lived through.
Okay, I don't expect much under Bush. Now, President Obama's come in, and I understand he's actually issued a regulation, or at least starting to actually stop mountaintop removal. Is that true, or does he need to do more?
It's a nice start, but it's not nearly as far as it needs to go.
What's he done so far?
The Obama administration is working hard through its EPA to limit future mountaintop removal operations.
So the 500 mountains, they're kind of still gone, but at least more mountains won't be blown up. Is that fair?
No. I mean, for instance, they permitted one giant operation and said, well, hey, we've reached an agreement with the coal company, and it'll only be half as toxic.
Oh, no.
It's called Hobbit 45.
But are they not reaching new agreements at least? Is there any positive thing to end this? I mean, there may be no positive news.
There's one potential veto of the single largest mountaintop removal job in history out there. But the problem, Mark, as we saw under the Bush administration, and as you know, administrative decisions can be undone.
Well, sure, and if Obama is no longer president, and Mitch McConnell or someone like that gets in there, or Newt Gingrich or Sarah Palin, then it's going to be built drill, baby, drill, mine, baby, mine.
So right, and so we need a law.
So tell me specifically.
And it just so happens there are two laws that are in Congress right now.
What are they called, and what can people do to help you pass those laws?
H.R. 1310. Call your congressman. Tell your congressman to co-sponsor this bill. Called the Clean Water Protection Act.
Clean Water Protection Act.
And essentially end mountaintop removal. In the Senate, it is S-696, a bill that has bipartisan support. Senator Lamar Alexander, a Republican of Tennessee,
wow,
who loves his Appalachian mountains, and Senator Ben Cardin, a Democrat of Maryland who loves his Appalachian mountains, have teamed together to bring an end to mountaintop removal. Those two things would make it much harder to backtrack should, heaven forbid, some gang of industrial thugs, as ran around in the Bush administration ever get hold of the government again.
Well, one thing I do know, being an ex-congressional attorney, is that those bill numbers change because a bill technically dies at the end of every 2 years. So it may be 696 and 1310 now, but hopefully it will pass this Congress. But if it doesn't,
we have great hopes that they will pass during this particular Congress, Mark.
Oh, good.
And in particular, 1310 has over 160 co-sponsors, and the only reason it can't get out of committee is because my congressman
blocking
it.
Your own West Virginia congressman.
Yes.
Who presumably gets a bunch of money to run from a certain coal company? I'm just guessing here.
No, actually, he's very well connected to the UMWA. Massey doesn't love him so much. They're running Don Blankenship's running a Republican against him in November.
Well, why is he blocking this bill then?
Got caught swanning around with him on the Riviera when Don Blankenship had a $50 million judgment before the Supreme Court of West Virginia.
Well, then I don't get it. Why isn't this congressman on your side? What's his name?
Nick Joe Rahal.
Nick Rahal. Why isn't Nick Rahal on your side here?
Because Nick Rahal is mesmerized by the jobs argument. And it's mountaintop removal yesterday, mountaintop removal today, and mountaintop removal forever.
So in order to help the people,
Nick Joe Rahal is standing in West Virginia's schoolhouse door saying no.
So in order to help the people of West Virginia, who apparently can't help themselves, you need everyone, no matter where they live, to call their member of Congress, to call their senator, and to ask to support the Clean Water Protection Act.
And the Appalachian, the Clean Water Protection Act and the Appalachian Restoration Act.
And the Appalachian Restoration Act.
The time is now when the rest of America has to decide if we in Appalachia are as American as a New Yorker, as a Vermonter, as a Washingtonian, a Californian. Is Appalachia America too?
So basically, they need to ask their elected representatives to ban mountaintop removal and to make sure that what mining does go on underground is at least safe, so we don't have 29 miners dead. And as Bob points out, that's just the tip of the iceberg, because three a day, are dying of black lung disease. Bob, our time's almost up. One thing I did hear in the news is that the U.S. attorney for West Virginia is going to prosecute for crimes some of these people at Massey. Do you think anything will come of that?
Sure. He'll find some shift foreman and make his life miserable.
Oh, so you don't think he'll go after the Don Blankenship?
And he'll take the fall for Don Blankenship.
Well, that's part of the problem with corporations. I think they should go at the top. If corporations are going to get First Amendment rights under our Constitution, I think they should go to jail, too. And the best way to do it is to jail their boards of directors, something I've called for. Bob, thank you so much for coming on the show, for sharing the misery of West Virginia, but also the beauty of it as well. And frankly, if you go down to some tourism, you can help West Virginia escape the coal mining pass and join the tourism future. Bob Kincaid is a host, talk radio host on the Head On Radio Network. Thank you, Bob, again for coming on the show.
Mark, thank you for allowing me to share a little bit of the story with Leslie's audience.
I appreciate it. I appreciate all the work you do, Bob. I know it is your passion as well. It should be. You're trying to protect your area. Folks, if you want to check me out, just go to my website. It's RadioInsideScoop.com or MarkLevineRadio.com. You can see all my recent appearances on Fox and MSNBC and all that good stuff. And I'll be back here hosting Leslie's show this Wednesday, 7 to 10 p.m. Don't miss it, but I'm signing off now.